Welcome to the Goddesses of Social Work podcast, hosted by Renita Ray Davis, licensed clinical social worker, board-approved social work clinical supervisor, and facilitator of the Goddesses of Social Work supervision community. Join us as we travel through the social work journeys told by the Goddesses of Social Work community members, past and present, as they make their way toward clinical licensure.
Welcome to the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. I'm here today with Alexandra Burke, LCSW. Alexandra Burke, LCSW, is a social worker who consistently practices across the span of human existence, engaging in social work at the macro, meso, and micro levels. Alexandra earned her associate degree in addiction studies from SUNY and her bachelor of social work from Marist University in New York. She moved to Chicago and continued her education, earning a master's degree from Jane Addams College of Social Work in Chicago, Illinois, with a specialty in community and administrative practice. Alexandra has clinical and administrative experience in both the nonprofit and corporate sectors, working in human services, but also in human resources, administrative management, and consulting. She considers herself a student of life who strives to learn something new every day. She is respected by her colleagues for her collaborative approach to treatment, her direct, unique, and creative interventions with clients, and her ability to speak truth respectfully to power. Alexandra enjoys spending time with her family, traveling, and surrounding herself with good friends with whom she can share a laugh. Alexandra's hobby is advocating for common sense reforms to policy in the areas of mental health and education. Welcome to the show, Alexandra.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel really honored to be able to talk about social work and talk about the things that matter in social work.
I'm so glad you said yes. I really am. Alexandra, I love the hobby listed in your bio, advocating for common sense reforms. How would you explain what common sense reforms are?
Well, what's the thing that common sense isn't very common anymore? You know, I'm a girl who asks questions. I ask questions, and when things don't make sense, I ask more questions, which makes people either annoyed by me or like me. So, you know, for example, you know, one of the things that I would advocate for is, you know, at a meso level, is we have lots of technology in teaching our kids. We need to teach parents how to use the technology if they're not familiar with how to navigate those things, because otherwise, there's a disconnect, right? It's not, somebody didn't intentionally not include that, but I think it takes different perspectives and suggestions to create the best possible outcome. You know, common sense is, you know, when it comes to chronic truancy, one of the things I've done with our state education is kind of challenge them a little bit about, help me understand your goals about chronic absenteeism, because we collect so much data that if you're just looking at days absent, that is not giving you the cross-section of people you want. You want days absent, grades, behavioral referrals, right? You want to look at that cross-section of kids because that's who you want to target your interventions to. Kids who aren't showing up for school on a particular day, or maybe they have 26 absences, how do we know that they weren't on a 10-day vacation with their family? Because I think spending time with your family is important. You know, how do we know that they don't have an illness in the family, right? So I just think it's a matter of asking questions when things don't make sense. And I'm fortunate enough to have a husband that supports me in, you know, being able to ask questions, even though sometimes he wants me to ask them a little less and to less people. So, I mean, that's, to me, that's what common sense is, you know, why do we have an attendance requirement for, you know, you can't miss more than 5 days of classes in your driver's ed, but if you have COVID, you have to stay home for 5 days and then you'll fail your driver's ed class. Like, those are the kinds of things that don't make sense to me, right? So advocating for after school programming in the schools. We're talking about how childcare is an issue in this country. Guess what? If we have schools and after school programming, we make up the education gap, we increase the strength of communities, and then we have a childcare option. Because in my perspective, while 0 to 3 and Head Start is important, if the 5-year-old is home watching themselves after school, that is not, we're not doing the right things. We're not targeting all of the things we need to target, right? So, and I've seen that at a micro level. I've seen it where 7-year-olds are home because, you know, mom, single mom working, doesn't have childcare. Grandma is home sleeping because she works third shift. So the kid is basically unsupervised. That's not a plan for success for a kid or family. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, I get really passionate about. I think, you know, we talked about how, to me, social workers are advocates. So, you know, people have said to me before, like, something about lobbying. And I always say, like, I don't need to be a lobbyist. I'm a social worker. Advocacy is part of who I am. Whether I get paid for it or don't, I don't get paid for any of, you know, my advocacy work. I'm an advocate. That's what my profession calls me to do. And I really think that many people who are social workers, it's more of a vocation as opposed to a job. So, you know, I think I was a social worker at 5. You know, it's just the makeup of who I am as an empath, you know, the experiences that I've had in my life. Yeah. So that's what I mean by common sense.
Yeah. Let's jump into that part. Yes. And always social workers ask questions. Always, always, always keep asking questions throughout your career. But let's jump into that. I would love to hear about, you were a social worker at 5. Tell me about your social work journey before we get into the meat and bones of our conversation today. How did we get here?
So my mom, God bless her, she's passed away, but she would tell a story about when I was 5, we went on a cruise, which actually went and stopped at Port-au-Prince in Haiti. And as we got off the cruise ship, I would always get a dollar to spend at whatever port we went to. And I noticed that there were children jumping into the water because passengers were like throwing quarters or something like that, throwing money. And there was something about me that just really connected with those kids. And I asked my mom, can I give my dollar to this kid? Instead of, you know, like, to me, there was something just dehumanizing about, you know, throwing, you know, things into the water for kids to go retrieve. Like, it just didn't, even at that age, it just didn't feel right. And, you know, my mom, I have to give her so much credit because she was a woman who was really a woman of incredible faith and kindness and compassion, and was a travel agent. So I traveled all over the world. And I think that was really important because I got to see that not everybody had the same standard of living that I did. And I think, you know, as a person who grew up in a mostly white affluent town, that was really important in shaping my desire to create change. So I went to school. I thought I wanted to study and work in the field of addictions. I started the first part of my career there. Kind of worked in all the modalities, worked at a therapeutic community, which I don't think we have very many therapeutic communities left, if any. Worked in a detox, worked in a 28-day Minnesota model, worked as a youth advocate, and then moved to Chicago, worked in child welfare, then went to grad school, then was given an opportunity to create a alternative to incarceration program for gang-involved youth, using the multi-systemic therapy program and the model out of South Carolina. Took some time from social work, because I think if anybody's been in the field for a really long time, we know that we can get burned out pretty quick. You know, there's a lot going on. We're responsible for a lot. And that gave me some experience in learning other things like human resources and working in a law firm. And, you know, I've always said, like, the experiences that I've had professionally, I have wanted them to teach me something so I didn't have to go to school for that degree. So to educate myself as globally as possible, while getting paid and not having to pay tuition.
I love that. And it feels like, you know, we're about to get into the meat and bones of what, why I was excited about having you on, but it feels like all of that experience has led us to our conversation today. And so, Alexandra, jumping right on in, one of the reasons I was excited about having you on the show today was to discuss the Social Work Compact. Recently, you wrote an open letter to social workers discussing some talking points that aren't openly being discussed. But before we delve into those, for those social workers who may not be aware of the Social Work Compact, can you explain what it is?
So the Social Work Compact is a multi-state license that would, instead of having to apply as a social worker in New York for a license and then having to apply for another license in Pennsylvania and then another license in Maryland and then state by state, it would allow you to apply for a multi-state license, but states have to agree to participate in it. It has to be something that the states want to do. And there's lots of resources talking about which states. I think right now there's 26 states that are proposing the Social Work Compact. And I'm not an expert at the Social Work Compact, but my understanding is that in 2001, the Department of Defense decided to fund kind of the exploration and creation of this to serve military families, which makes so much sense to me, because if we have someone who is actively serving and their spouse is a social worker and they get stationed outside of the state that they're licensed in, we don't want those people to not be able to practice because their spouse is serving our country. That's, you know, that's a disincentive, and we want to support those families as best we can. They're the reason we have a democracy, right? So we want to be able to empower those social workers who move because they're married or, you know, involved in the military to continue to practice. So out of that came the CSG, which is the Council for State Governments, is the body that creates these multi-state licenses, also called interstate compacts. And so there were people from, you know, NASW, I think there were two or three chapters chosen, Clinical Social Work Association, and then the ASWB. It's not very clear to me, even though I've asked, you know, how were chapters chosen from NASW, which chapters or which states? I don't think that NASW has given us a lot of clarity about that. And I can't speak to the other two because I'm more familiar with NASW. So that's what a social work compact is. The pieces, and I think, well, I'll let you ask your next question. Did I answer the question?
Yeah, you actually did. And I, in fact, didn't even have any questions in that because you did such a good job of answering what the Social Work Compact is. And 26 states are interested. And certainly right now, what we know to be true is 26 states have it and on their legislative schedule to go up for the process, but not any state has passed it yet. Is that correct?
One state has ratified it. That's Missouri.
Okay.
But they ratified it on a day when they also took some actions that other people may find objectionable in terms of the LGBTQIA community.
So there's some talking points there as well then. Yeah.
And that is not something that I'm well versed in. I'm not super familiar with Missouri. I don't even know how to follow my own pieces of legislation in my state. I'm working through that process because it seems very complex. And I think that's, you know, one of the things we talked about is like, what are the barriers for people practicing? Bureaucracies and bureaucrats that don't really want us participating aren't giving us seats at the table or even seats in the room. You know, I think it can be complex, and I'm a complex problem solver. I love looking at, I mean, that's what we do as social workers. We look at systems, right? We look at either the system of an individual, if it's micro, the system of a community, if it's meso, maybe even the state, and then the macro piece, right? What's going on, you know, nationally, and now even to some degree, what's going on internationally, right? Because we know that we're an interdependent planet. So in terms of, I think one of the things you had said is, that I had originally stated that I was for the compact, and I was, and here's the reason why. I see college kids. I have college kids, and I have had, a few college kids who came to me, and I had been working with them for, you know, 2 years before they went away to college. And so under the emergency declarations for COVID, I was able to treat them across state lines until December 31st of 2022. And then as of that time, I could no longer treat them. That felt wrong to me. And I think it puts, you know, both legalities and ethics in opposition, because we can't abandon our clients, but we're also not able to see them across state lines if we're not licensed in that state, unless the country decides we can, because we were able to do all of these things when it served the greater need. We still have a mental health pandemic. We have an epidemic of loneliness. So the only thing that has changed is the bureaucracy and the bureaucrats who will not allow us to continue this work the way that we did under the emergency declarations. And so that's why I was in favor of it. I was like, okay, I don't have to worry about, you know, seeing these kids who are going off to college who then struggle. And it's not reasonable for them to drive 3 hours to see me every week. And it's not necessarily, we know that mental health is over capacity to some degree. So me saying to a kid who's going to Iowa, well, why don't you find a therapist there? I mean, yeah, I'll wait on a waiting list for 6 months. So it just didn't feel good to me in terms of continuity of care, abandonment of clients. But, you know, my hands are tied legally in terms of not practicing in a state that I'm not licensed in. So that's why I was for it, because I do understand that it reduces the barriers to access. The reason that I started to really think about it and dissect it was because there were just too many pieces that no one was talking about. So I feel like we have been given a pro-con list by our social work associations, our professional associations, that has no cons. That's not a pro-con list. That's a sales pitch, right? So if you're not giving us a balanced picture, that's not helpful to me, right? Because social workers are overburdened, we're underpaid, we don't have a union, we don't have people who necessarily look out for us in the way that I would want them to, right? And so that's why I started. I spoke to an attorney, I spoke to a liability company, I spoke to a professor. I mean, I spent money and time to try to fully understand this issue. And then I wrote something about it because I'm like, if I'm going to spend the money, I'm not just going to like leave this knowledge here with me. Like, let's tell everybody. Give me a bullhorn. Like, let's tell all of the social workers. I just think it's a matter of educating ourselves, right? And that can be really hard when you have a caseload of 40 and you're coming home to two kids who have to go to badminton and theater practice, right?
So yes, all of that. You're absolutely right. And one of the things we talked about before we hit record was I was in a CEU recently on social justice and human rights, and social workers were asked what were the barriers to just getting involved in that arena. And it was truly, they just are tired because social workers are overworked, overburdened, overcased. We have, you know, 50 million and 11 things that we are responsible to and that our code of ethics say that we are supposed to lean into. And now you also want me to read. And I think you said the social work compact was 26 pages long to try to understand. And so when we're being given this information, this is, go team, this is a good thing for the profession. And we're all believing that it is. I'm so glad that you put in the time and effort and money to find out what the pros and cons were. And so I would like to keep it balanced. What were some of the pros? And then will you talk about, since we have not heard about the cons, do you mind sharing what the cons were as well?
Sure. So the first thing I have to say is, I think this is a great example of how social work works, because a professor provided me with an analysis that her students had done, right, as a macro assignment, which then I read and I was like, wow, these are great points. And then I started thinking from the clinical perspective, from the micro perspective, okay, how does this affect me as a clinician? Right. And so I have to say that if it hadn't been for that professor and it hadn't been for those students, because it doesn't matter how long you're in the field, you have something valuable to say. You could be in the field for 2 days. If you have insight, share your insight. I also want to say my attorney is a saint, because I call him all the time and ask, like, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? Because I'm not an attorney. I'm not going to read 26 pages of legislation. I don't have the time or the bandwidth to do that. I did read a fair amount of the compact. And so here's what I would say are the pros. I think the pros are it minimizes the CEU tracking, which can be arduous, right? If you're licensed in 5 states, keeping track of what's for this one and what's for that one. I think it does reduce some barriers. Other than that, I'm not so sure. Like, I think the interstate practice and the ability to increase bandwidth is great. I think when it comes to serving military families, I support it 100%. We should fast track anything that has to do with a spouse who is a social worker of a person who is active duty. That's my personal opinion. When it comes to the cons, as a social worker, I think in terms of how do we inform our clients, right? How do we help them self-determine, and how do we ensure that we are obtaining informed consent? So part of what this was for me is I didn't really feel, based on what I was seeing from our professional associations, that social workers were being given the information to have informed consent to participate in this, right? Like, you know, if you sell me a house that, or if you show me a house that has all new fixtures and it's really beautiful and all new walls and painting, but there's termites in the rafters, that house doesn't look so good, right? So I think it's really about the pros and the cons, a balanced message. So for me, the ability to navigate that some states, especially around like the hot button trigger issues, whether it's women's rights, whether it's gun ownership, whether it's duty to warn, the state that I'm in has 100 laws governing confidentiality. That's why I have a great attorney. 100 laws. I can't keep track of them. I went to school for social work, not for law. So, you know, I go through my informed consent for treatment with him. He helps me figure out. Some clients say, you know, minors' records are complete, are protected at the age of 12. Other states do not have that. So to me, I saw it not just as a policy issue, but really as a practice issue, right? So if you're in a state, and what the compact says is you are bound by the laws of the state that your client is residing in, right? So if I'm in the state that I'm in and there's a red flag law, but I have a client who's in Maine where there's yellow flag laws, I have to be aware of that. And I have to be able to explain that to my client. Here's the other piece. There is not infrastructure in place. And this to me, I think, is one of the most serious clinical issues. There's not infrastructure in place that if your client is in an emergency, you can call 911. Because if I call 911, it's going to ring down the street. It's not going to ring in Maine. So that to me is a piece that we kind of have overlooked. And you know, I'm sure that there are social workers who hold licenses in various states now and maybe have their own way of figuring that out. But I just thought that was something for other social workers to just kind of be aware of. I'm not trying to sway people one way or another about supporting the compact. I'm saying this is what I have learned. I encourage you to ask some questions, do a little research, and then based on what you're hearing or seeing, form an opinion and then contact your legislator and tell them whether you support it or not. Because, you know, it's a big change. They're not talking about doing it in phases, which, you know, I've been at some companies who have decided to make some big changes, like to their technology operating systems all over the whole company. And it didn't go well. You know, it didn't go well when the phones were down for 4 days. So I guess I think a phased approach helps us to see where our blind spots are.
And, you know, I know we didn't pre-talk about this, but I'm going to ask, and if you don't want to answer, that's okay. One of the concerns, I think, reading over some of the concerns or the cons that have been shared with me recently are some of these organizations that are privatizing mental health and what that could potentially look like for states that are a part of the Interstate Compact for Social Work. Would you like to speak to that?
Speak to that only a little bit, because I know that it's an issue, but I also don't know a lot about it. I mean, this is what I can say. I would want my state to enact legislation that protected social workers from predatory for-profit corporations looking to make mental health care like Doc in the Box, because it's not the same. It's just not the same. And we know that. And we actually know that from people talk, from people's reviews who are on some of those corporations. I got a different therapist every time. I could hear that my therapist had somebody else in the car with them. It did, you know, so it's not the same. It's not the same level of care that I would provide. And so I think it, that's the other piece of it is, if we're creating a system where someone in a state who has, you know, a lower rate of reimbursement for social workers, right? If they're going to pay somebody $40 in that state an hour, whereas in my state, I might be paid $70 an hour, and an interstate compact would put me out of business. Because they're, you know, I don't think that's going to be the case with me, because I do think that private practice, the people who come to see me, come to see me. There's a reason. Everybody knows that that's out there. But there's a reason they come to see me, because they want to have continuity. I have a good reputation in the community. I am known as an advocate and as a social worker who goes above and beyond. And things out of the box. So I don't worry about it putting me out of business. I worry about it from a standpoint of really good clinical care. And, you know, we don't know what we don't know. So I think that's the piece for me, is I would want my state to enact legislation to protect us from things like that before they became part of the interstate compact.
Yeah, it's the Wild Wild West out there. That's what I was calling it. There's no regulation. And you know, I don't know where this question is going, but when you were just talking, happy Social Work Month, by the way.
Yes, you too.
Yeah, but the NASW just put out in its proclamation that social work is one of the fastest growing professions in the nation right now. And I'm thinking, as you were talking about all the up and coming social workers who are about to be in the field, and this happening right now, couple of thoughts I was having is, some of the ones who are coming, one, I loved how you said social work is vocation for some of us and it's a job for others. And so thinking about those who may, this may just be a job for them. The privatization of mental health care and this compact license might be an easier way to become more successful for them, right?
At a lower wage.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we're going to undervalue people who are already undervalued. That doesn't sound like a winning combination for any social worker. Like that, I mean, truly, people pay for what they value. So if you value me $35, you are wanting somebody else.
That part. And you might have somebody in the car with you while you're getting it.
Or not have the same clinician the next time. You know, I think expansion of services and expansion of mental health is critically important. But it's also critically important to do it right. Right? It's if we were creating a building, we wouldn't just throw a bunch of cinder blocks together in a year and be like, oh, we have a building now. We would have an architect. We would put it out for bids. We would do all of this stuff. And the compact is not something that I will be applying for. I will not be applying for a multi-state license because I don't have to. If I want to practice in a different state, I'll go get licensed individually with their state. And if they don't let me, guess what? I guess I'm staying in this state. I just, to me, that's not the right decision, because I think there's too many risks. And I think the other one that we didn't even talk about is, and this was a real example where someone had licenses in many states and forgot to turn in their CEUs. 2 days late, maybe a week, who knows? They were not only sanctioned in their state, they were sanctioned in the 20 something other states, because one state sees one state. And so that becomes really I think, a challenge. I think, you know, definitely liability companies could then decide to not provide malpractice insurance to you. And I think it becomes hard to explain 26 times, not to mention it exhausts any professional regulation board defense funds. Like, they're gone in like 3 days if you have 25 cases. So, you know, I think those are the other pieces. The other thing is kind of you have to submit your biometric data in order to participate. Well, who's going to have that data? I mean, I think we're openly talking about like systems being hacked by governments who aren't necessarily wanting to support America, right? So I just think those are all of the pieces that when I think about, is this the right decision for me? It's not at this time. I think we'll see where it goes.
And I know you, again, you've stated you're not an expert at this. You wrote the open letter. It was very, and we'll make sure we put that open letter in the podcast episode description so other people can read it as well. And it touches on many of the points that we're talking about today. But, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about is counseling has an interstate compact, psychiatry has an interstate, and, you know, as a social worker, I've been doing this for over 2 decades now. It feels like we're always trying to prove that we are just as professional and as valuable as psychiatry, psychologists, and the like. How does our social work compact differentiate from the counseling and the SCIPAC, and they seem to have successfully created theirs?
I don't know. I mean, that's the real answer is it took me enough to try to go through our proposed compact. I could not even look at SCIPAC. The nurses have one. What I heard or what I saw is that now because of SCIPAC, some employers in SCIPAC states are requiring different things of their employees. So for instance, you know, if you have a standard consent to treatment, now you really have to tailor that for all of the different states based on the different states' kind of confidentiality laws or duty to warn or those kinds of things. So I'm not a good person to ask about that. And I don't know anyone personally who holds an interstate license. I don't know if it's the demographic area that we're in where we don't need to kind of expand beyond the state. So I'm not able to answer that.
That's okay. Just wanted to put it out there. It has been done. But you're right. I don't know anyone who holds one. That is interesting. But also I am multi-state licensed, and I don't practice in all the states that I am licensed in. And part of it was because my clients were moving into other states. And so even having or holding other state licensures, I might only have one or two clients in each one of the states that I'm licensed. And so then thinking about being licensed in 26 states, and I don't even have in my private practice, there's no way that I would see clients out of all 26 states. I'm wondering what, if there's going to be particular state requirements on top of whatever the interstate compact requirements are going to be, would it even be worth it?
I think it addresses that, in the compact. It talks about, administrative things, I believe, follow the laws of the state that the clinician is residing in or licensed in, whereas clinical issues follow the laws of confidentiality and duty to warn of the state that the client is located in. I also think that social workers we're different than psychologists. The work that we do is really different because it's so expansive, right? I think the work is different. And I think, you know, I don't know how that opens us up to some of the differences too, in terms of navigating this. And I think, to me, the interstate compact and the multi-state license is great. I guess I just think, you know, I didn't send out the first draft of my letter that I wrote. So I would like to see the social work community, not just the associations or the people that get picked to have the seats at the table, where it becomes like, what's that game where they take away a seat? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Musical chairs. Yeah. Yeah.
Around the circle. And so I'd like to see, instead of us taking seats away and being like, this is the draft, I'd like to see us have seats and make it better, right? And maybe part of that is, I know that, in fairness to CSG, they did have some stakeholder meetings, but when I looked at their piece that they put out, groups who participate in the development of the social work licensure compact are listed below. Please note that this does not signify an endorsement of the compact. And then there's no groups listed. So, I mean, I think it's one of those things that we talked about before, which is, I think many of us as social workers are in the weeds of trying to do the work, right? Whether it be as school social workers, whether it be as child welfare workers, whether it be working at DHS, whatever it is, whether it be in private practice. And so you have to pick what you educate yourself about. And sometimes there's no room to pick that because I have to educate myself about my kids' badminton schedule, right? And so I just think, for something that is so important, I have concerns about like running with the first draft. I think we need more input. With that being said, I think we have an excellent opportunity to support military people by trialing it with them, right? And giving them as much support as possible in terms of the multi-state license, and making sure that it works, and then seeing the blind spots and saying, okay, this is something we can change. This is something we can fix. This is something we can improve. That's just my thought.
I love it. And that's why you're here, to tell us your thoughts. I'm also curious, why do you think all of a sudden, I've been doing this for 24 years, this will be my 24th year. Why do you think all of a sudden an explosion of 26 states are pushing this legislation right now? And you may not have that answer.
Well, I can tell you what my gut says. What? My gut says that it's either about politics or money, because that's usually what it boils down to. I didn't learn that lesson until I was like 45. When I was like, oh, it really is all about power and money. Oh, okay. But I would be willing to bet that it isn't necessarily, and I'm not saying that's about the Department of Defense. I think the Department of Defense honestly wanted to support spouses of active duty. But I think my gut says it's about politics, money, or power. So, I can't say for sure. I'm not in the hearts and the minds of those people, but I will not be applying for a multi-state license until I have seen how it works in practice first.
I hear you. You know, you're so involved on the macro level as a clinical social worker. And I just want to acknowledge that, right?
Because thank you.
I've been talking to some clinical social workers who do the macro work. And I know we do that work for free. we don't necessarily get paid for it. And so really, you know, my last question, Alexandra, is talking to clinical social workers and, you know, licensed master's level social workers as well, because it's going to affect all of us. What call to action advice could you give those of us that are going to be affected by this legislation?
Personally, I would write your legislator, if it's being proposed in your state, and tell them you think we should defer action on this until after the presidential election. There's no rush. We haven't had the reality is this. If someone can wave a magic wand and we can all practice across state lines without any need for this, we don't have to rush. Someone can wave another wand and say there's a mental health crisis epidemic. Let's implement a state of emergency for that. And guess what? We don't need this right now. So I just think it's a matter of being smart. I think it's a matter of not being afraid to disagree. I mean, I have to say, like, I have critics and I am okay with that. You don't have to like what I say. I try to be respectful in disagreement, but my husband, who is just a good guy, I think he told me that a football coach said, a man with no critics is a man with no successes. So I am okay with critics because it means that I have had the courage, tenacity, and integrity to stand up for what I believe in. And my kids see that. They do that for themselves. They do that for their friends. I learned that from my parents. My dad marched in the civil rights movement. He was 57 when he had me. So I am really grateful to be part of a profession that allows me to do this and calls me to do it. And I think that's a gift.
It really, really is. And, you know, I want to kind of stay there for just a second, because I think, you know, I meet so many social workers who are doing micro practice. And, you know, it's because their hearts are so, so big. But one of the things I think we have to remember with social work, if we're going to be advocates, we're not winning a popularity contest, right? And so I think a lot of social workers, as social work is one of the fastest growing professions, are coming into this field. They want their clients to like them. But in order to get stuff done in social work, you're not going to be liked. You're not going to be very popular. And so we have to be able to talk about these issues and say, hey, y'all, wake up, pay attention. Don't just sign on the dotted line just because it feels good.
Right? Because it's just the kind of the duality of the work that we do, which is, you know, very compassionate and loving and embracing and non-judgmental and client-centered. And then there's this other piece, which is, you know, very much about advocacy for the underserved and marginalized. And right now, I think the social workers are underserved and marginalized to some degree. We are under-supported, underpaid, and overburdened. So we have to advocate for ourselves. And sometimes that means not following what the professional organizations are telling us. And it means sending a letter to our legislators saying, hi, I vote. I'm a social worker. I have a vested interest in this. I'm a double stakeholder. I'd like you to defer this.
Absolutely. And that's our call to action. That is our call to action. Alexandra, thank you so much for coming on the Goddesses of Social Work podcast and talking about this very tough conversation today. I learned so much.
This is great. I'm really grateful for what you're doing. And I just feel really honored to, you know, be part of it and be somebody who gets to advocate for social workers, because we're worth it. Right. We have to know our value so that we can communicate it and hold people accountable to treating us well.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Goddesses of Social Work podcast. We are glad you were here. If you like this episode, please come back to hear more stories of the journeys through social work, and please leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. See you next time here on the Goddesses of Social Work podcast.